Happy Tuesday, Payload Nation and Pathfinder listeners, and hello from Miami. That's right, Pathfinder is coming to you on the road or from the road, and let's just say that we are hot, bothered, and sweaty, but that's quite all right. We have AC, we have our podcast gear, we have an internet router, and we've got a great guest today. Before we dive in, let's hear a word from our sponsor. Our reliance on satellites for navigation, communications, commerce, and intelligence has grown exponentially in the new space economy. Unfortunately, the risks have grown as well, and the need to prioritize cybersecurity around space assets is critical. SpiderHawk Mission Systems provides space cybersecurity products for military, commercial, and civilian operators. Their OrbitSecure solution is the first to deliver zero-trust security to zero-gravity environments, protecting space communication, command, control, data transmission, storage, and integrity at the data level. I know that like the back of my hand by now. To learn more about OrbitSecure, check out their website at spideroak-ms.com. Again, that's spideroak-ms.com. Now, on to the main business of the day. Today's guest is Tom Weiss, the CEO of Sierra Space. You might have heard about Sierra Space. They've had quite a bit of news this year, and we're going to unpack that on the show. So, without further ado, Tom, welcome to Pathfinder.
Hey, Ryan, thank you for having me. It's great to be with you today. I'm looking forward to our conversation.
There couldn't be a better time to do this. You've had a slew of announcements, and I'm really excited to dive into them. But first, I noticed that your one-year anniversary is coming up. So preemptive congratulations. That's one-year anniversary at Sierra.
Yeah, thank you for that. It's been a great year, a really great team. We've made a lot of progress, and I think we're well-positioned for the future. So it's been a great year, but a great team.
Mm-hmm. And a busy year too. I'm to be sure. We're running through your resume in reverse chronological order, but I'm going to get us back to chronological. And so let's hear about how you got your start in aerospace. And I know you spent many decades in aerospace.
Yeah, you know, it's been a great 40 years in aerospace and defense. You know, I started in the 80s, really while going to college, working for at the time called Northrop Corporation. You know, I was very focused at the time around control systems and got involved in what is now known as the B-2, which is a stealth long-range bomber, and really perfecting, you know, the integration of electromagnetics, advanced electromagnetics, and the ability to really focus around building large aircraft that were very aerodynamically, but also disappeared on radar screens. And that merging of electromagnetics and aerodynamics was really an exciting challenge for us. And we perfected that. And a number of products really came out of that era, not only B-2, but today, you know, you can read about the B-21 and a number of things in between that we don't talk about. So that's how I entered the industry. Spent 31 years with Northrop Grumman, became the president of the Aerospace Systems Division, which is about 23,000 employees, $11 billion a year, but just some incredibly talented team members doing some revolutionary things. You know, we think about when we get in, you know, getting your Tesla or EV car today and the amount of automation that's in that car. You know, we were doing things like that a decade ago. One of the Collier trophies that we won, if you don't know the Collier trophy, that's sort of the you know, I think it's the best prize in aerospace for advanced work in aircraft. And we won the Collier Award for the program we called the X-47, completely autonomous, landed on the deck of aircraft carriers with just commands, able to go in and refuel, find a tanker in flight, refuel itself, connect to the tanker, refuel itself, and then go on to its mission, again, completely autonomously. We went from, it was incredible.
Yeah, no, I think that's a really under-discussed but important point that the proving ground for most autonomous, you know, software and guidance systems is really air and space. I don't think that doesn't get talked about enough.
Yeah, you know, we talk a lot about, you know, what's coming out of Silicon Valley and the car industry today and autonomy. You know, imagine doing that with an aircraft in 3D space where you have to understand everything around you, find a tanker, rendezvous with a tanker, understand what you're looking at when you rendezvous, connect, and then start taking on fuel. And then, you know, what your mission is and how do you think about traveling across halfway across the world and understanding how to prosecute a mission all in autonomy. And then moving from what I call autonomous systems to AI-enabled systems, where, you know, you start to bring systems that were, from deterministic systems to non-deterministic systems. And so we're really prided ourselves on that. One of the most amazing products that we worked on is now obviously on orbit, the James Webb Space Telescope. And, you know, here was an instrument that its purpose was to see back in time, you know, over 13 billion years and understand the very first light from the very first star.
And the first HD photo is actually coming out, like, I think the day or the day after.
4 days.
Yeah, it's really exciting.
A couple of days, yeah. So I'm very excited, yeah. And, you know, along the path of understanding, okay, is the Big Bang a theory, or now can we prove, in fact, it's the way that the universe started? That's one aspect of the telescope. The other is, you know, can we find habitable planets around distant stars that can maintain life? Whether that life is carbon-based or silicon-based is still yet to be understood, but... And then we built the fastest, everybody talks about the chip manufacturing today and the speed of the chips. You know, Northrop Grumman still has, I think, the record, the Guinness Book of Records for the fastest IC chip in history. We ran that chip at a terahertz for advanced imagery. So a lot of really things that we just loved. And just going back to the space aspect, many, many things that are in space today from Northrop Grumman, the thing that I... always a sense of pride was every human being that stepped onto the surface of the moon stepped off of a Northrop Grumman vehicle called the LEM.
There you go.
And so that was my first 31 years, and it was kind of an amazing ride. And then started working in startups.
I'm sure it's a little bit liberating when some of these things get declassified, having lived that PSSCI clearance lifestyle and working on very, very, very sensitive programs.
There's always a sense of pride because, you know, what we thought about all the time was our mission was around preserving and protecting freedom and advancing humanity's understanding of this larger universe in which we lived in. And some of those things, you know, can't be talked about, won't be talked about, but we pride ourselves in knowing that, you know, people could go to bed at night and feel safe because we were always at the ready doing the things that we needed to do to protect our great nation. It's a great sense of pride and a lot of really cool things that we did along the way. You know, fighters, electronic attack. Ryan, we could manipulate the electromagnetic spectrum at will and still can. Right. So,
this is crazy. And you said earlier, you know, imagining the complexity. I can imagine the complexity. I cannot empathize because I am but a lowly emailer and a podcaster. I appreciate the hard work and the complexity because this stuff is definitely crazy to think about, crazy to talk about to the extent that you can. So moving on to startups actually, and Sierra. I don't remember the exact date, but Sierra Space, this is now an introduction to the current job, but Sierra spun out of Sierra Nevada.
Correct.
And so can you walk listeners through why the decision to spin out? And then we'll then talk about the raise and then move on to what you're working on now.
Yeah, you know, Sierra Nevada is an amazing company of just incredible technologies focused around a whole spectrum of national security interests and commercializing space. And what we decided along with obviously Fadi and Aaron Osman, the owners of Sierra Nevada, was that we could unlock greater value both for SNC and unlock greater value for the commercialization of space. And that's exactly why we did it, and it's proven itself out. So we see more value creation now occurring in Sierra Nevada, and of course, great value creation with Sierra Space. And so that's why we spun it out, and again, a year later, into this experiment, so to speak, it's proving that exactly the reasons why we did it are in fact playing out, and we're creating that value for our shareholders.
I don't recall exactly when, but you raised a very large Series A. I'm putting Series A in air quotes because it was what, $1.4 billion?
That's correct.
And that was 6 odd months ago. When exactly did that close, or when was it announced?
Yeah, we finished up and announced in December of last year.
Okay. Given the macroeconomic conditions and, you know, just the direction that it looks like the economy is heading in, does that help you sleep easier night knowing that you got that closed and don't have to worry about, you know, raising a massive round in these current conditions?
Yeah, you know, we were pretty thoughtful as we went through 2021 and looked at a variety of factors and the economics. We played a lot of what if games, tried to understand upside, downside. So we tried to anticipate lots of different scenarios, is why we ultimately decided to raise the 1.4, so that one is we could finance the technology and, you know, our approach we'll talk about a little bit, and that is to bring this very unique platform to the market. And so raising that kind of money, and we wanted to be able to do that through, you know, several years and not have to go back out into the marketplace to fund the base of business. And if there were to be a downturn, this is last year, we could weather that. I clearly want, I think about some of the companies that are trying to navigate through this economic volatility, and especially the capital markets. And, you know, that's going to be tough. I think we're in a very good position. We've got very strong investors. Obviously, we've got both Aaron and Fadia on as investors and on our board, but we have really good investors. We think about General Atlantic, More Capital. Obviously, we've got Coatue and BlackRock and A Industrial. So we're quite proud of what we raised, but we've also got very, very unique long-term investors.
So it's a powerful cap table, a fortified balance sheet. That's all. It's all obviously very, very important for a capital intensive business like this. So this is now, I have all these segments in my show notes titled Space Plane, Astronaut Academy, Living, Working, and Playing in Leo. So here we go. And let's start with the Space Plane. Why don't you tell us a little bit about Dream Chaser and where everything on the Space Plane front, where you're at there?
Yeah. Is it possible, Ryan, just maybe back up a little bit? Because I think it's important to put the company in context and then jump into, you know, some of the products we make, one of which is a very unique Space Plane. I think it's important first just to talk a little bit about, you know, Sierra Space's strategy. Our mission really is to leverage that we're a completely vertically integrated space company, and we're leveraging that position and the deep tech that we have to be a true end-to-end technology and business platform. And I think that's very unique right now. We're this idea of a true end-to-end. And so with that in mind, you know, now we can talk about, like, what do we use this platform for?
I'm really happy that you made that distinction, because it's not just one part of the company that you'd emphasize. You know, it all works together as a platform. So yes, with that in mind.
Yeah, I think it's not, you know, we're not a Dream Chaser company. We're not a space station company. We are a true platform company that is bringing, you know, a revolutionary new way of thinking about space transportation systems and destination networks and underlying technologies, along with third parties and partners, to create this ecosystem that really is focused on end customers, that create massive value for our customers. But at the same time, Ryan, it also creates, you know, pretty high barriers for anybody, any of our competitors. And so on the space transportation side, you know, we think about, you know, Dream Chaser. And Dream Chaser, again, is not a single product. Think of Dream Chaser as a family of space planes. And we start with, obviously, the first mission to the International Space Station next year for cargo resupply to the station. In addition, it's nice to have not just the $1.4 billion in capital, but, you know, we're sitting on a $3 billion backlog contract with NASA for cargo resupply. And we start those missions next year. But we take that Dream Chaser first vehicle cargo, and now we have an entire family of vehicles that we're working on. Internally, we call that cargo variant 100. 200 now is already in full development. 200 is not only crew, but it is even more upmass in cargo. And so we think about the first part of our strategy to create a platform is having the ability then to have a transportation system that can scale as market demands. So we go from 6 tons in cargo, 6 people, DC-200 comes online, and now it's, you know, significantly more cargo. Ultimately, we think about, you know, a full range up to DC-500. And that's how we think about this family of space planes. The other thing that's very unique is, as you well know, we're still bringing people back from space the same way that we did in the 1960s, except for a very brief time with the space shuttle. We're still either plunging people into the ocean or putting them on, you know, in the dirt, you know, in a capsule. We like the idea of coming back from Earth. And although we're this unique vehicle, we're flying at Mach 25, and when we land anywhere, a single aisle 737 or A321 can land. And you've probably been seeing our announcements that we're creating these partnerships. So 3 landing spots in the U.S. already, obviously Kennedy Space Center, Huntsville, Alabama, Spaceport America, New Mexico, obviously the OITA Airport in Japan, Cornwall Spaceport in the UK, and we continue to build these out. Now, that's interesting that we can land horizontally again at all these different runways. But the other thing that's part of this ecosystem play is think about where's the next Silicon Valley for space tech going to happen, right? So when we start landing frequently in Huntsville, think about what's going to happen in Huntsville, right? That's going to be all kinds of incubators around space tech. And again, local economies, but again, it strengthens our ecosystem. And so that's why we think it's unique, highly reusable, 15 times. It brings the cost of space down. We've been able to think about being able to launch Dream Chaser on multiple different launch vehicles, and which is a very unique happening, right? You think about the ULA, SpaceX, Blue Origins, Mitsubishi Heavy Industry, Ariane Space. But you also think about some of the up-and-comer innovative players, you know, like Rocket Lab. I think, Peter's doing some amazing things. You think about what's happening to Relativity Space. You know, if those companies actually are successful in doing, you know, what they're talking about, let's say in the case of Relativity Space, 20 metric tons to low Earth orbit at a fraction of today's cost, we get to take advantage of that because we build the unique space plane and then we partner with launch companies that are building very powerful rockets at fractions of the cost. And so that's how we think about the transportation side of this.
Hey everyone, this is Ryan Duffy from the future popping in. Next 10 minutes or so, my audio and video were unsalvageable. So I just re-recorded a couple questions that I asked Tom in this next segment. Here's the first one. Your comments remind me of a line from Apple CEO Tim Cook that you need to control your supply chain and the underlying technologies to control your destiny. Do you also agree with this view at Sierra Space?
Yeah, I am. I've been studying and a fan and building and buying, you know, Apple products since the first kit came out. You know, obviously when the 2E came out. And so if you think about what is Apple, I mean, there's lots of people say, what's the example of a platform? People will use Amazon, they use the internet, they use Google. And I think Apple is a very interesting platform play. You know, their platform is iOS, right? The interface devices are things that we call iPhones and iPads and Apple TVs and HomePods and those kinds of things. And then they build out an ecosystem of all these services, whether it's healthcare or movies. And so I tend to think of that end-to-end platform that builds these service ecosystems and partnerships on top. That's the example I would use as we think about the Sierra Space platform that we're bringing to the new space economy. And I think that's for us, it's an interesting way to think about how to capture that. You know, app developers for us or people like, you know, Redwire, you know, Made in Space, TechShot, all those companies are coming onto our platform.
And here's the second question that was re-recorded. I mentioned this in the first episode with Michael Sopradini, who's the CEO of Axiom. but essentially I was asking him about Bill Gates's definition of a platform. I think it's attributed to Bill Gates, and that is a product that generates more total economic value than it captures. So for example, services and apps built on top of it are worth more than the product itself. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the platform is not just a technology platform, but it starts with that. But it's also a business platform, and that platform creates massive value for the end customer because you're starting to build an ecosystem play on top. You're adding services, third parties. So that's what we're bringing, and that's where you get this massive end-to-end value. But you got to own the technology platform. You got to own that business platform. And then you bring partners to build an ecosystem. And then it's very, very difficult for anybody to come in and compete against that, because you're not only competing with the Sierra Space and the Blue Origins and our partner, you know, other partners that we have like Redwire and Boeing, but you're competing with all of the third parties on that platform. And I think it's just that it proves itself over and over again. And we're just taking it from the terrestrial meaning to now low Earth orbit.
Okay, time for a short break to hear from our sponsors again. Space is the new frontier for cybersecurity. SpiderHawk Mission Systems build space cybersecurity solutions for civilian, military, and commercial space operations. Their Orbit Secure protocol delivers zero trust security to zero gravity environments, protecting space communication, command, control, data transmission, storage, and integrity at the data level. To learn more about how zero trust architectures will revolutionize security in new space, download the new NSR SpiderHawk sponsored white paper titled Space Cybersecurity, Current State and Future Needs. Find the white paper at spacecyber.com. Again, that is spacecyber.com, or check out their website at spiderhawk-ms.com. Tell them Pathfinder sent you. All right, this is Future Ryan Duffy with my third and final re-recorded question. I am a little fuzzy on this one, but I am pretty sure I asked Tom something about the killer app for Leo in the next 5 to 10 years, or particular business applications or industries that he thought will take off first in the coming golden age of space stations, transportation, what have you.
Yeah, if I could, let me kind of step back a little bit and kind of give you this you know, thought that I keep coming back to, which is what makes this period of time so profound, and why are we talking about this innovative new platform in space that's going to create the ability for, you know, companies in traditional industries to break, you know, the next breakthrough products in healthcare, telecommunications, semiconductors, energy, and the like. And so let me provide sort of a perspective, and let's maybe have a good dialogue on it. And that is, if I think about, you know, people at the time who were sort of witnessing, you know, the advent of the steam engine, you know, the advent of electricity, the internet, the information age, did they really understand the profound impact those innovations would ultimately have on civilizations? I would argue that they didn't. You know, it was few visionary saw it, but the collective, you know, humanity, while they're even in it, really didn't understand, I think, the long-term implications. At Sierra Space, I think we can see into the future, and that's why we're building this. I think that we're already in the next big revolution, the most profound period of innovation in human history. And it's an industrial revolution that I think is building on every revolution that's come before it. And, you know, I've had the opportunity to kind of been a revolutionary in some of these technologies. And this one is profound. The signs are really all around us. You know, we've sort of termed this as the orbital age. And so I like to kind of talk about, you know, what's the things that defined this orbital age? And so there are many, and maybe we'll walk through and we can have a sort of discussion. But, you know, the orbital age is this revolution I talked about, and it's being driven by these underlying technologies that we see around us today. Reusable rockets have lowered the launch costs so significantly. You know, the SpaceX, when they were first doing their Grasshopper project that ultimately got into a Falcon 9, and today it's just, you know, it's everybody just assumes it. But they really transformed, you know, lowering launch costs that made getting into low Earth orbit affordable. And today, I mean, just more rapid, more frequent than ever. The second thing I would say is it's an era that that's, you know, we're seeing a transformation a transition maybe from 60 years of human space exploration to human space exploration commercialization. And it's marked by that we're pivoting from an era where just a handful of professional astronauts were going to government space stations to now we're transitioning to thousands of people that are on a fleet of space planes going to a constellation of commercial space stations. And I think the other thing that's going to help people understand that we're in the midst of this orbital age is, existing companies in every segment of the industrial sector, whether it's biotech, manufacturing, energy, they're going to operate in the microgravity factories of the future. And we're going to just extend our cities and communities, 250 miles up. And, I think of, we're just defining, like, Earth isn't just about what's on the surface. It's now Earth is extending up to 250 miles, and that's the ecosystem that we call Earth. So that I see that is really what's happening here. That's what the most exciting part is. And that's why we're really excited to build a platform that enables this orbital age to occur.
A lot of your counterparts have shared with me that they believe that space is sort of in the early internet days. Do you agree with that? Do you think that there's a better comparison, or do you think that it's, you can't really draw those comparisons?
Yeah. Again, I think many people jump right into the internet age, but just because it's so top of mind, and we've seen what it's done in the last 20 years. One of the things that I kind of think about is the early days of the railroad. We're building a place that we call Earth Base One, and I liken it to Grand Central Terminal. Like, what was Grand Central Terminal in 1913? It really introduced this mass movement of people, and this idea that we could move quickly across this great continent, where before it would take just massive amounts of energy and patience and time to do. And so I think we're sort of at that stage where we've got railroad lines being laid, and now we've got these super highways coming into place, and we've got these bridges to space occurring, and now we've got these bridges being built. Now we're building out the next cities, just like the railroad did. What did the railroad really create? It was economies across the United States, cities being born, new developments, the gold rush, all of that. I like to use that analogy because the internet one, it's played so frequently that you sort of get lost in it.
Maybe there's recency bias there too, just because it's a very accessible, more kind of recent, the advent of the internet.
Yeah. Right.
So let's talk a little bit about Orbital Reef. And because I think that ties together a lot of these threads, and you've spoken about working with partners too. And of course, like the space plane has to go somewhere, like the astronauts have to go somewhere. A lot of these use cases in space, like manufacturing, for example, need a platform in space.
Yeah.
Just walk us through Orbital Reef and how that's going, and just the scope of the project.
Yeah, it's pretty exciting. I mean, just touching upon what you just said, I mean, the nice thing is that since we have both parts, we have the destination and the transportation, more destinations, more people going up, more things being manufactured in space drives the transportation business, which we think we have the best transportation network in the industry today. Having a low-cost transportation drives greater access to space and more destinations. So that's why I talk about this end-to-end. On the Orbital Reef side, we have a powerful partner with Blue Origin. And we've got, it's not just technology synergies, but there's a lot of cultural synergies. And of course, we've got a teammate that has the ability to invest in these as well. So we reduced the capital risk, we've increased the technology invention, and we understand really around the business and the business aspects and how to create a platform. So we're pretty excited. We start launching the first elements of Orbital Reef in 26. We have
on orbit and operational by 2027, right?
In 2027. So we start getting the elements in 26. We've got about six new Glenn launches Dream Chasers are taking cargo and crew up, and then we build out the components, and we're open for business in 27. 3 years before the International Space Station is expected to be retired. And so we're servicing both ISS and we're servicing our orbital reef. And then ultimately we see a potential constellation of space stations. We've always believed that it's important to start from day one on a free flyer, new commercial space station, and allow us to put that station in the right inclinations. We believe there's many inclinations and altitudes. So we try, you know, we were a conscious decision not to have to rely on the ISS to get started, but build a free flyer. And that's what us and Blue Origin have been very focused on. You know, on our team, you know, Boeing, if you think about Boeing, has 30 years of ISS design, 20 years of ISS operation. So all the things on the, not only all the things that worked well, but all the things that it didn't work well, and having that background and applying those lessons learned is powerful. You know, most of the astronauts' time on an ISS is trying to keep ISS flying. You know, we wanted to reduce that to just, you know, very minimum. And so that we have a very reliable, a low, astronaut time required to keep it flying, let the astronauts really get into running experiments, manufacturing products, taking care of customer needs.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think we've written quite a bit about the critical need to you know, ensure continued access and have that, you know, handoff, the sustained presence in space, and they're not, you know, we don't want a gap where there's no access to LEO after the ISS is deorbited and decommissioned. And it sounds like the timetable gives you a few years of margin, so that you know, gap won't exist. And you actually, I wanted to ask about, to the point of de-risking this from a capital perspective. And I suppose that this question encompasses Dream Chaser as well. But we've talked about your fortified balance sheet. We've talked about how you're working with partners. We've also talked about the NASA contracts and, you know, generating revenue like before the station will be up there. Is there any other part of the equation that I haven't just mentioned, or you probably can't or won't, but do you have any estimates for what the all in, you know, capital expenditure for getting orbital reefs, what that will look like?
Oh yeah, we know exactly what it's going to cost and what we budgeted. I typically don't go into that in public, just given that there are others out there working to this. But no, you have to know that. You have to know what exactly the non-recurring cost is, and because this is what you have to think about, what your customers are going to pay. And to drive a great commercialization of LEO, you have to significantly drop the price of operating on our platform. So we make trades between the non-recurring cost of developing and trade that for lower cost of operating. And so that's how we think about, you know, operating this for the future. And so it's really around low cost of operation, you know, so the utilities, you know, one way to think about this, Ryan, is, you know, we think of ourselves on the destination side as being the largest real estate developer in LEO. But we're also the utility company, right? So we provide, you know, power, you know, life support, oxygen, you know, water, all those kinds of things. And you have to do that in a way that really brings the price down. So, you know, the telecommunication industry thinks about their next product is in orbit, and now they get an ROI for that product, you know, invention. Or biohealth, the same thing. When we think about tissue generation, or, you know, artificial retina, or stem cell research, or that new oncology drug, you know, it has to have an effective ROI. And so, you know, that work in space has to play in. So that, I think, is our competitive advantage, is we think a lot about low cost of operating in space to drive the business to space.
Yeah. Yeah. My God. I mean, you've got a cool job. Like these are all very, very, I mean, you know, obviously it's high pressure, it's high risk, but these are very, very fun things to be working on.
Yeah. It's a great, it's way beyond me. I mean, this is a really incredible team. You know, our president, Dr. Gavandi, you know, she is a, you know, three-time astronaut, you know, Wren Glenn Research Center. You know, we have Steve Lindsay, who is five-time astronaut, runs advanced programs. Our chief operating officer ran all of Lockheed Martin Skunk Works. Our CFO, you know, ran the, you know, $30 billion business, or the CFO for Boeing's $30 billion BDS business. We got people from SpaceX, high tech industry. And so it's a team of people that are very, you know, courageous collaborators that are focused on this differentiated outcome. And that's what's been making us successful. We started at the beginning of the year at about 1,000 people.
Teamwork makes
the
dream work.
1,800 will be 2,000 by the end of the year. And so we're growing the team and stay focused on what we do best, which is this innovative platform. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Tom, you have quite a fantastic LinkedIn bio. And we of course, I don't have time to read the full thing, but I will link to it in the show notes. But I wanted to call out that I think one aspect of that that will resonate with a lot of our listeners is you lament that, you know, jets, that we're not flying any faster than we were 40 years ago.
Oh yeah.
So I thought that was interesting to add to, and this is an actual quote, we will enable humanity to live, work, explore, and vacation in space. I wanted to ask you about that. And let's say 3 years into operations in the orbital age, if you will, do you have any projections of what the share between those four things will be? So, you know, living like, and maybe that's not the right way to think about it, but I suppose what I'm getting at is what your initial markets or key use cases will be.
Yeah. You know, I think the large driver in the space economy is going to be the development and production of new breakthrough products, again, from healthcare, telecommunications, cloud computing in space, clean energy, different chemistries being invented, advanced materials and purity of materials. I mean, all those things, I could go into a number of use cases, but I really do envision that there's something deeply emotional, almost religious about going to space, look back down this beautiful blue dot. And again, I'm a Carl Sagan fan, but everything we've ever known, everything we've ever done, everything humanity's ever created has all been done on this beautiful little blue planet in this vast sea of the universe. And it's a very special place. And what you realize is we are one human race. There's no borders in space. That's, you start to understand the, you know, the beauty of cultures and cultural integrations. And, you know, you sort of think differently about humanity. You think differently about what it means to be deeply human. And I think just that has a profound effect. I want people to experience that. And so I want this not to be, you know, just for billionaires, you know, I want humanity to experience it. And so I do envision that when people think about in the future, how to have a life experience, you know, where do they want a vacation? Where do they want to go to learn? Where do they want to go create that next sort of, you know, outcome for them personally, then space is definitely has to be on that list. And so creating hotels, Airbnbs, I'll think of it as, you know, people owning flats in low Earth orbit. You know, I've already sort of thought about, you know, I have a design for the first beautiful restaurant on one of our space stations. And of course, the name of it is obvious.
What's the cuisine?
Yeah, it's got Asian flair to it.
Oh.
And the name of it is Blue Dot.
Amazing. I love it. That's great.
Yeah.
I think that, and I don't want to speak for an entire industry, but I think that most people on Team Space would share that sentiment with you, just that, you know, it's not meant to be catered to like the billionaire class. And that, I think that often just gets misconstrued when you're talking about a general, you know, talking to a more general audience or
are non sort of space savvy. But I also think that someone who
right.
When William Shatner went to space, he had his comments were similar to yours. They were very poignant about just the overview effect, just the power, you know, of seeing that, of looking back at Earth.
Yeah. It was, you know, it was similar to when, you know, we were sitting around a conference room with a number of scientists, a cosmologist. This was back at Northrop and James Webb. And we were thinking about, like, what is it going to mean when this small team of engineers and scientists finds the first life on a distant planet? What will that mean? How will we feel? And it's just, it's incredible to understand the emotional effect those kinds of breakthroughs have. And I feel that today, you know, in the same thing, if we could get more of humanity understanding this unique, beautiful place in which we live. Sierra Space is not trying to leave Earth. We love Earth. We're trying to make it better. And I just think it's a way to think about having a profound effect on people. And so hospitality, tourism, experience, learning, you know, it's like the first time you, I don't know if you ever, you know, you go and you decide if you're a climber, you know, you're going to, you know, first travel up to base camp in Everest, or, you know, if you've ever, you know, traveled to the top of Everest, it isn't about a mountain climb, right? The mountain climb is just how you get to the experience of having a profound effect on yourself. That is what is important to us. And I think about, of all the things that we could do, if somehow Sierra Space and our partners on this platform can create the breakthrough cure for adolescent leukemia, like, that is huge. That makes all of this worth it.
Totally, totally. Well, I think we're pushing up against time, and I think that that's a really good place to close out. There's so much more that we could talk about. We'll probably have to save a lot of the topics for round two. Sometime in the future, maybe next year when Dream Chaser's flying. But I want to close out the show with a few lighter questions. What's your favorite piece of sci-fi, if you like sci-fi? And are you by any chance watching For All Mankind?
Oh, of course. It's actually interesting. I just hope somebody's actually explaining to young kids that that's not actually how it happened.
Yeah, there's so many parallels.
So you see Right Stuff and you go, okay, that's really well done. You see, you know, this incredibly, the way they've done this, it's so well done. I'm just afraid that some of the younger kids are going to say, wait, mom, dad, like, we weren't first in Moon. But it's incredibly well done. And so,
yeah, it's right. It's premised on that, the counterfactual, but eventually I actually don't want to give anything away.
Right. But well done. I mean, I'm a huge Gene Roddenberry fan. I grew up in Star Trek, and I still make sure that we're clicking off all the Gene Roddenberry inventions. You know, we still got the cloaking device to do, and you know, we've got warp drive. But, you know, was it 5 years to go? Maybe 10 years ago now. And, you know, Caltech led an initiative to find out that, you know, gravity waves were in fact real, and so could you hop gravity waves and condense time, and so maybe we could actually prove Einstein was a little wrong. We actually can travel faster than the speed of light through warp drives that Gene Roddenberry, you know, just made up in the 60s. And so I love sci-fi. You know, I love space. You know, The Martian was kind of interesting because some of the, you know, stuff about the plant growth, you know, that's Sierra Space. I mean, we're the largest plant growth developer. And we did it not because of, you know, food, although that's a byproduct, because plants are really, really quite good at developing water and oxygen.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you get sort of all these products.
I love how multidisciplinary this conversation has been. My last question for you is, when are you going to space? Are you going to space?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
You have to try that restaurant.
Oh, yeah. And I'm the food critic. And so, you know, Janet, you know, Cavati is our, like I said, is our president. You know, she's running all the Human Space Flight Center and all the astronaut training. She says that I have several hard years of training ahead of me. You know, I'm not sure she's going to graduate me or cut me.
No special treatment.
No special treatment. But
good.
I am working hard to be in the first crew of six on the first launch. So I'm looking forward to it.
Well, we'll have to check up on that in round two, schedule permitting.
All right.
And
astronaut training. I know the regiment's intense, so so hopefully we'll be able to fit in around two. But thank you so much, Tom, for coming on the show. This has been great.
Yeah, thank you, Ryan. It was really great to meet you and great to talk with you today.
Alrighty, all that is going to do it for episode 0007 of Pathfinder. I want to thank Tom not only for the insightful discussion, but for his patience. I had a lot of technical glitches and even got the boot from our recording while we were recording. I also want to give a shout out to Courtney Lewis, our producer extraordinaire, for smoothing over all of said glitches and producing the polished end result that you are hearing or watching now. Anywho, I hope you came away from this combo with some fun new knowledge, or that our chat gave you inspiration for space cocktail party chatter, or at the very least, that you are fired up for the future in low Earth orbit. Shout out to Spider Oak Mission Systems for helping Payload and Pathfinder keep the lights on. If you like what you heard, leave us a 5-star rating on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. We are coming for Joe Rogan. We need all the help we can get. And if you have Pathfinder feedback, constructive criticism, or suggestions for guests, or you just want to say hi, email me at ryan@payloadspace.com. If you're not already signed up to our awesome space newsletter, I do say so myself, sign up by going to payloadspace.com. Lastly, we have a triple header of Pathfinder recordings next week, and I can't wait to tell you more very soon. I'm going to start opening up the question and show preparation process by tweeting out a teaser of who we're talking to and asking y'all on social media if there are any questions that you want us to ask our guests. So keep an eye out for that. And all right, with that, I am Ryan Duffy signing off, and I will see you back here next week.